My guest at this time is Larry Haas. He is a former spokesman for the Clinton White House Budget Office, but he's been a longtime columnist and commentator on the international stage as well. He's the author of the brand new book, Sound the Trumpet, The United States and Human Rights Promotion. And Larry, it's always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Greg. Thank you.
Well, you basically kind of chart the way forward a little bit from the American founding, but really from the end of World War II to the present time, and how human rights promotion has kind of shaped American foreign policy and in different ways, depending on the administration, of course. To begin with, you kind of define what human rights are. I think most people would probably say, certainly from their American experience, that people have basic rights. Those rights are extended to all people, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, and so forth. What more depth do we need to understand about the term before we dig any deeper?
Well, it has actually been a term of some controversy, because you see, in the West, we have focused heavily on political rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, political process, freedom, things like that. And we have said, as you said, that rights derive from the fact that someone is born. We think it is actually part of a person's humanity that they have rights at birth. You know, not too many years ago, when we were fighting the Cold War, the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, had a completely different sense of human rights. They focused on the economic side, not that they provided real economic rights anyway, but they focused on the economic side. They had no interest in providing political rights, and they didn't think that rights derived from the individual. They thought that they were derived from the from the generosity of the state. So human rights have been actually more controversial than you think. But in the West, there's been a consensus that they do mean basic political rights, civil liberties, things like that, the freedoms of speech and of assembly and the things that you mentioned.
Your book chronicles many of the human rights challenges that we faced, from Harry Truman on to President Obama, so we obviously can't touch on all of them. But what are a couple that stand out most to you as successful efforts that we've led in other countries that have led to the kind of human rights changes that we had hoped for?
Well, I think definitely the most striking one has to be the victory in the Cold War. I mean, here we were faced off against an empire of hundreds of millions of people who were literally enslaved. They had very few rights. It was, of course, in our national security interest, in a very kind of hard sense of the term, to contain the Soviet Union and eventually to win the war. But by promoting human rights, by drawing distinctions between our form of government and the alternative, by seeding democratic movements, both publicly and behind the scenes, we eventually chipped away at the Soviet Union, and by around 1989, 1990, 1991, brought the Soviet Empire down. So that is the one that really stands out. But over time, we have done it in all sorts of other ways. Look, the Marshall Plan saved Western Europe from the temptation of communism in the late 1940s. We moved into the Balkans in the late 1990s, used air power to protect the people of the former Yugoslavia, and saved hundreds of thousands of lives. We joined with the Europeans recently in providing the rebels with some assistance in Libya that brought down Muammar Gaddafi and has given that country a chance at freedom and democracy going forward, and they are trying to work that out as we speak. We fed, we helped save and fed tens of thousands of people in Somalia in the early 1990s and prevented much more death than was already taking place. So there's been quite a bit of success over the last 75 years, and we should be very proud of the successes that we've had, even though they've been very challenging in many ways.
We're talking with Larry Haas. The book is Sound the Trumpet. Larry, you mentioned the Cold War, and in the last couple decades, we saw two very different strategies. One was detente, containment, and some folks said that we probably would have seen the same result if we had just followed that same policy. The last decade, of course, in the Reagan administration and so forth, there was much more direct rhetoric, and some people say that hastened the end. So is one more effective than the other, generally speaking?
I don't think that there's much to the argument that somehow the Soviet Union would have collapsed no matter what we did, which is really the argument of those who believe in detente. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the policy of detente, as practiced by Nixon and Ford and their national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, was a way to ensure that the United States would have its sphere of power, the Soviet Union would have its sphere of power, and things would continue that way forever. It really was when Reagan came in and decided that we had fought long enough in the Cold War and we had an opportunity to actually win it, to weaken the Soviet Union over time and eventually to get countries in the Soviet bloc to break away and in essence bring down the Soviet Empire, which we were able to do, that really hastened the end. We promoted human rights in a big way. We funded and otherwise assisted dissident movements. We built up our military in a big way with the idea that the Soviets would never be able to compete with us. We took actions that hastened the end of the Soviet Union. I do not buy the argument that it would have happened anyway, or certainly I don't buy the argument that somehow it would have happened on the same time frame.
Let me get you to respond to some of the arguments made by those who don't think that human rights promotion is necessarily the best foreign policy, and you address this in your book to some extent. Some would say that while there are the successes we've talked about, and others certainly since the end of World War II, that in other situations, perhaps our intervention or our lack of intervention made bad situations far worse. They point to the Iranian Revolution, the late 1970s. Some would say even now, as much as we didn't approve of what Mubarak did, bringing in perhaps more radical elements in Egypt could destabilize the region in a bad way, certainly for Israel and so forth. So how do you react to that, and what's the best way to make sure that doesn't happen?
One has to take the long view. One has to understand that change is difficult in the best of circumstances. I mean, keep in mind, the United States declared independence in 1776 and did not have a working constitution for another 13 years. It was not until 1789. So change is hard wherever it happens, even in places where it has been considered a success, obviously starting with the United States. So that's number one. You've got to keep your eye on the long term. Secondly, with regard to the Middle East, the Arab Spring, some would say that by promoting freedom and democracy, we have allowed radical elements to take over in Egypt and to potentially take over in other countries. Actually, I think it's quite the contrary. The fact of the matter is that those dictatorships were creaky and out of date and doomed to failure because they were providing nothing for their people. Revolution was coming. We did not work hard enough to set the stage for democracy. By supporting those dictators, whether it was Mubarak in Egypt or some of the other places, the Shah in Iran, we, in essence, allowed radical elements like the Muslim Brotherhood to work behind the scenes, to wait until their time came, and in a time of turmoil, to allow them to capitalize on it. What we should have done through the course of these recent decades is really not tie ourselves so tightly to dictatorship, but to seed the ground for democracy in that region just like we were doing in other regions. Yes, there are risks involved. Yes, we make mistakes. But there's no question that the game is the long term, and to the extent that you can move the world towards freedom and democracy, the world benefits, and more importantly, we benefit. So I don't think the problem is that we somehow tried. I think the problem is we didn't try hard enough in that region, and we're now suffering the consequences.
The other issue that has been brought up, certainly in this presidential campaign, at least when Ron Paul was part of it, was the fact that our interventions have perhaps, in some cases, like we've already referred to, not turned out the way we'd like to, but they would also say it's piled up a price tag that we can't continue to deal with. How do you react to that?
Well, there's no question that some of this stuff is expensive. Certainly, we spent hundreds of billions of dollars fighting the Cold War over the course of half a century. So it's not necessarily cheap. Having said that, a lot of the most effective things that we do actually don't cost any money. There is nothing more powerful in the world than the president's voice. The voice of the President of the United States. When a U.S. president promotes freedom and democracy, either across the board in general or with regard to particular countries, things happen. Authoritarian regimes are on the defensive, and dissidents all over the world gain encouragement. And it really matters. You see it happen. You saw it early after the turn of this century when President Bush was promoting freedom and democracy all over the world, and you saw things happen, whether it was in Ukraine or the Republic of Georgia or places like that. And you know what? Those places have made progress. The Republic of Georgia has actually made real progress. And the examples can go on, both back to the 1950s as well as in the recent period. So it doesn't necessarily have to be expensive. We are going to be allocating foreign aid. It's a tiny portion of our overall budget. It does not bankrupt us in any way. It's a good investment. And to the extent that we use our dollars to help democracies and pressure authoritarian governments, we make the world a better place. That doesn't cost that much money. So I don't really buy the argument that somehow human rights promotion is bankrupting us. Yes, sometimes it costs some money, but it is well worth the investment.
Do you feel like the rest of the world understands the idea of human rights the way we do? And I'm specifically thinking about the UN. On the one hand, when there are quote-unquote humanitarian crises, you mentioned Somalia and elsewhere, the UN is usually playing some sort of leading role. At the same time, we see the Human Rights Council often populated with some of the worst actors in the world. So do you get the sense that others understand this the same way we do?
No, I think there's no question that there are many places in the world where countries do not share our values. I think the greater Middle East is still, unfortunately, at the government level in many ways, still one of those places. You're right about the Human Rights Council. We need to be very clear about what we believe in. We believe in freedom and democracy. It doesn't mean we believe necessarily that it has to be precisely our way. But we have values that we believe in. We believe that freer societies are good societies because they give people an opportunity for prosperity. We believe that democracy is the best system because it gives people a stake in their government. We believe in transparency and accountability, in free speech and free assembly, in tolerance, in gender rights and minority rights. We should be proud of that. We make the world a better place, and to the extent that we have conflicts with societies that don't believe in these things, that's okay. But we should promote what we believe in because we should be, in essence, remembering that these values serve us well, they serve other countries well, and we have nothing to be ashamed of.
Larry, we'll have to leave it there. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for your time, as always.
Well, thank you, and I hope people will go out and buy Sound the Trumpet.
Sound the Trumpet is the title, The United States and Human Rights Promotion. Larry Haas, former spokesman for the Clinton White House Budget Office, longtime columnist and commentator on all sorts of issues, including on the international stage. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.